I stand before you at an indecently early academic hour and do so with some sense of irony because the discipline I represent, the one generally called musicology, has tended to be characterized by its belatedness. In this respect, musicology keeps good company with its principal object of study, which, being nonverbal and mostly non-representational, has typically struggled along two or three steps behind the main cultural posse. Composers and performers and musicologists may peer forward through the dust cloud, trying to spot what's going on ahead, but they make slower progress because, more than most, they are forever glancing backwards, anxious not to lose sight of home. Even given this state of affairs, the roll call of recently belated musicological enthusiasms is impressive, the discipline's perennial tardiness having remained stoutly unbending even in the face of instantaneous global communication systems. The 1980s, for example, with everyone else in the humanities seemingly awash with post-structuralism, was our high point of high formalism. We called it analysis, and its ferociously technical, often alienating metamusical language bolstered the sense, celebrated by some in the discipline, of being isolated from others in the humanities. Even further into the time warp, those same 1980s saw the birth of several self-styled monumental critical editions of music, initiatives occasionally trumpeted with startling 1950s-style triumphalist rhetoric. Now, the 1990s then witnessed a pendulum swing with the rise of so-called new musicology. It preceded New Labour, but only by a few years. It was a strife-torn movement that characterised itself as anti-formalist and paraded as major enthusiasms a sudden interest in newfangled approaches such as feminism and narratology. Around the turn of the millennium, some young musicological blades were even becoming cautiously interested in deconstruction, although quite how to apply its precepts to the musical object remained and remains a formidably dark and savagely contested topic. 10 years later still, as I stand before you, these disciplinary ripples have settled down. Hardly anyone now mentions the new musicology, but this is a mark of its success and ubiquity rather than its decline. Its former standard bearers are now, after all, grey and distinguished, symbols of authority rather than revolution. The chief casualty of the polemic they raised has been, as intended, musicology's brand of high formalism, our analysis, which, at least in its purest institutionalized form, is now somewhat beleaguered, dropping out of curricula as those survivalists who remain committed to teaching it have reached retirement. Understandably, for those personally invested, the relative decline of analysis has been a cause for lament. But even these inevitable cries from the wilderness have died down. Partly this is a matter of demographics. One might somewhat crudely call it a process of natural wastage as the heroes of earlier vogues fall and cease. But our present decade also exudes a novel sense of relaxed pluralism. It seems as if in our newly fragmented, information-drenched world, it has become difficult to see musicological industry, or God help us, any other industry, simply in terms of Coleridge's dwarf mounted on the shoulders of a giant to see further. Indeed, the idea of dwarves mounted on anyone or anything, even on the shoulders of other dwarfs, an image more appropriate sometimes, one feels, now seems naive in its uninflected belief in intellectual advance. Most of us now wearily agree that whatever musicological subfield we occupy, the questions we ask and the answers we find about musical objects will not lead to some distant green hill of comprehensive understanding. On the contrary, we know that questions change with the changing times, perhaps slowly and perhaps with well-considered and necessary resistance, but change nonetheless. passionately as we may, perhaps should, argue the case of our particular enthusiasms, we also know that all disciplinary victories will inevitably become quaint and then ignored, like the people who espouse them most will, and quite soon, be forgotten. Now, the ironies of this thumbnail sketch of musicology will already be evident to many of you. Here we are, we musicologists, finally basking in the sunshine of a newly plural world, having wrestled to the ground the demon of hard epistemology that loomed over our ways of thinking, banishing that high formalism that once dominated our field and, as I said, led to isolation from our sister disciplines. However, no sooner do we find ourselves settled in this new state of aggiornamento, some of us perhaps entertaining visions of at last taking a place at the humanities high table, than persistent murmurs from elsewhere announce that we're again in danger of falling behind. What's more, the fresh departure that we missed when our faces were turned to the sun is in the circumstances the worst imaginable. Quite suddenly, people elsewhere are talking about a new formalism. To give just a couple of examples, an entire recent issue of Representations, the interdisciplinary house journal of West Coast New Historicism, was devoted to the topic of form, with 14 members of its editorial board contributing essays. Some of these essays admittedly chose to approach the idea of form in ways that might be thought generously tangential at best, even within the broadest definitions of that notoriously slippery term. But still, the intention, the call to order, or at least to attention, was clear. More pertinent still, and certainly more focused, was a review essay in a recent essay of PLMA, written by Marjorie Levinson and entitled What is the New Formalism? It offered to sum up critically a disciplinary departure that is, in Levinson's own words, now a movement of some significance. Has then the curse of belatedness struck musicology once again? Should we dust off our high formalism and embrace it anew? Now, those tempted to do just that will undoubtedly be hampered by some of the problems musicologists habitually encounter when they embrace the habits of other disciplines. The stuff lying at the center of the musicological project, the stuff that defines our difference from everyone else, is, as I said earlier, nonverbal and mostly non-representational, and is thus peculiarly resistant to many of the disciplinary modes that have proved so alluring and or productive elsewhere. On the other hand, especially among those still passionate about analysis, there are evident temptations to embracing the new formalism. Admittedly, and as Levinson states, it's extraordinarily difficult to pin down exactly what the new formalists stand for, the obvious reason being that they're resistant to theorizing their own positions, seeing proneness to such theorizing as a hallmark of what they oppose. Even so, it's clear that the new formalism has much in common with musicology's recently spurned analysis. In particular, and here I'm simplifying some of Levinson's arguments and distinctions, particularly in their shared attempts to shore up and celebrate high art credentials of certain repertories by means of addressing their formal properties and of finding in form either the or a source of pleasure, ethical education, and critical power, and also in their shared, related at least, insistence that close reading of these repertoires should be central to the disciplinary curriculum and an essential preliminary to wider interpretative moves. Now, I want, if I may, to concentrate here on the second of these similarities, on the insistence, about the insistence on close reading. And I do so because an interesting and significant difference may emerge here between musicology and its sister disciplines, one on which I want to place some pressure. Now, in the case of the new formalism, using close reading as a banner under which to march was always tricky. Whatever other sins they may have committed, the leading figures of deconstruction or new historicism could hardly be accused of not reading texts closely. Indeed, they typically read them with savage and minute scrutiny. Yesterday we heard Homi Bhabha quoting Edward Said's last writings with its explicit praise for and indeed pleas for close reading. A conventional new formalist way out of this dilemma has been to say that, of course, deconstructionists and new historicists close read, but that they did so in the wrong way, above all in the service of a narrow theoretical agenda without due regard for formal matters and the pure aesthetic pleasure and ethical boost that such activities are said to bring with them. Now, distinctions of this kind, though, have always, I think, retained a hint of desperation about them, particularly when what exactly constitutes formal matters is typically so vague and undefined. There's also the straw man issue. Despite decades of institutional strife in the humanities, it's difficult to imagine anyone going to the barricades of literary or historical studies with a manifesto that headlined an explicit rejection of close reading, in spite of the fact that these days our computer screens and inboxes ever before us, we all guiltily have leanings in that direction. But in spite of this, the Society for Text Skimmers does not yet exist. Now, switch to musicology, though, and just that unlikely manifesto has indeed been an important matter of debate. As Mary Ann Smart, the lone musicologist in the representation special issue, reminds us, at the height of the anti-analysis polemics in the early 1990s, Gary Tomlinson, then as now among the most influential of musicological voices, was much quoted for asking us precisely to question whether close reading should be the sine qua non of our musicological practice, saying that, quote, "it is the act of close reading itself that carries the ideological charge of modernism," unquote. Now, admittedly, Tomlinson went on to justify this statement in terms of a wariness about the aesthetic that would be familiar to the polemics of literary and other humanists, saying that, quote, "what we should do is interrogate our love for the music we study, dredge up our usual impassioned musical involvements from the hidden realm of untouchable premise they tend to inhabit, and make them a dynamic force to be reckoned with, challenged, rejected, indulged in, whatever, within our study," unquote. However, and caveats notwithstanding, Tomlinson's blunt questioning of the act of close reading was and remains striking. What was going on in musicology that could foster such opinions? How was it possible to make such statements in that discipline and not in others closely related? Well, the beginnings of an obvious answer, of course, lie in the word reading and the different value it carries when one deals with music, a medium that, as I'm sure you know, most of the time reaches most of us through the ear rather than the eye. Some explanation and historical background, I think, will be useful here, and I hope you'll forgive me if you know it already. So, what does it mean to read music? In the most obvious parlance, one that goes back a very long way, it means to be able to understand musical notation as a blueprint for performance, and then to have the ability to convert that notation into sound, sometimes for the pleasure of others, not in my case, but sometimes. Now, this ability is insignificant or unnecessary in many musical cultures where notation doesn't exist. It's worth reminding ourselves of that. But within elite Western music, it is assumed and has retained great importance. Indeed, and with gathering force since the early 19th century, musical notation accrued such prestige that it began increasingly to be read in the interpretative sense, thus approaching the close reading of other emerging, then emerging disciplines. The appearance of this latter-day interpretative musical reading has to do with large-scale shifts in musical production and dissemination during the 19th century, in particular with changing perceptions of the hierarchy between composers and performers, changes that saw the former's stock rising, at least in intellectual circles, quite markedly. The practice gained material substance with the vastly increased dissemination of the musical score, a document no longer merely regarded as a blueprint for performance, but increasingly as an aid to aesthetic contemplation, and even as an essential tool for satisfactory musical understanding and appreciation. As an example of this, the presence or absence of readily available musical scores became caught up in the defining 19th century European polemic about musical worth, which involved the opposition, the struggle between German instrumental music and Italian opera. Orchestral scores of contemporary Italian operas were not published during this period. No one was interested in them. Nor, and this is significant, were they used during performances, which typically relied on an annotated first violin part for the leader of the orchestra. When it came, though, to the rapidly emerging Museum of German Classics, those of elevated taste were now prone to insist that an orchestral score was essential to musical understanding. The most elite and serious among increasingly attentive and silent audiences even took to bringing scores with them to live performances. Now, there were several key agents in this pioneering score-based economy of the early 19th century, all of them still with us, although some now beleaguered. One was that newly emerging figure, the orchestral conductor. His task was recognized as partly the prosaic one of holding the orchestra together in increasingly complex works, and partly, of course, he had the more ancient task of keeping time. Of growing importance, though, was a new and defining skill, the conductor's knowledge of the composer's score and thus intentions, and his ability to communicate this knowledge to both the performers and the audience was now becoming extremely important. The conductor was, in this sense, a surrogate for the all-conquering composer, cementing the new, steeper hierarchy between creator and performer. As an example of the enthusiasm with which the conductor could be celebrated, let me quote you a passage from an English critic of the mid-1830s. Here's what he said. "The mere practical man acknowledged in the conductor a superior power to which he paid willing and grateful homage. He felt himself relieved from a load of responsibility and looked up with confidence and esteem to one who, with the wave of his baton, the expression of his countenance, or the glance of an eye, indicated his wishes and communicated his approval. Such a conductor says plainly by his manner to every individual who demands his immediate intention, 'I know your instrument, its scale, its powers and infirmities. I know the extent of your command over it. I know what the composer has assigned to your charge, what notes you are to bring out and what to subdue.' No wonder that the performer implicitly submits to the guidance of a man who, he is satisfied, will never lead him astray." Unquote. And if this smacks strongly of patriarchy and the all-seeing, all-controlling panopticon, then the Foucauldian resonance is startlingly confirmed in a later passage in the same article. When the conductor is at his most commanding, quote, "no pert or mutinous expressions escape from the members of the orchestra who feel their relative position towards a conductor whose knowledge is power," unquote. Now, a second beneficiary of this new concern with scores was, of course, the publisher, and publishers often had a central financial stake in musical journals, which were becoming enormously important arbitrators of taste. They quickly saw that the new authority musical scores might boast could be commercially exploited, as can be seen from the flurry of music, particularly newly authentic editions, now hitting the market. Indeed, the symbiotic effect between music publisher, journal reader, and musical consumer were a central driver, unexplored mostly, a central driver in these changes in musical taste. Now, a third agent of the score-based economy brings us nearer home. The new availability and prestige of musical notation allowed commentators of all kinds to indulge in a novel kind of musical scrutiny, and so emerged the first steps towards what we now call analysis, an activity which used the presence of the score to find in musical works previously unheard of levels of connection and coherence, especially in terms of long-range harmonic and motivic connections that are very easy to see on the page, but for almost all of us, impossible to perceive in live performance. Before long, professors of music were on the march, first lecturing and pamphlet writing, later setting up university music departments, and in their wake, institutionalizing score-based analysis. It's in some ways a small leap from their beginnings in the 19th century to our present classical musical world, in which a canon of works from the past is endlessly repeated, supposedly for humanity's edification, in which musical scores are fetishized as projections of composerly authority, in which it is assumed that analysis of these scores will be an essential step to enhanced understanding, and so on and on. And it hardly needs saying that another striking similarity between the musical world growing around 1830 and ours is the cultural pessimism that these attitudes inevitably engender, the fear that any new music will be depressingly inferior to the endlessly repeated and exhaustively analysed classics. I should add, and parenthetically, that there is one central difference. For the 19th century, the other standing in the way of the canonization of the classics took the form, as I said, of Italian opera, with its determinedly event-based rather than score-based economy. Nowadays, that nexus of opposition has all but disappeared, for the simple reason that the economy of Italian opera has been almost entirely absorbed by its former antithesis. It is now, for example, a noticeable recipient of those monumental editions I mentioned at the start of this paper. Our other to the classical is not then Italian opera, but it is a category of music that emerged only gradually during the 19th century in promenade concerts and other mass entertainments. Today, we call it popular music, and score-based it is not. However, the parallels between our present world and these 19th century innovations are still arresting. Earlier, I talked about the panopticon-like role of the conductor, but a better point of reference for the entire phenomenon of the emergence of classical musical culture might lie in Michel de Certeau's celebrated distinction between the aerial view of the city, denoting mastery, control, legibility, and the anarchic, resistant, forever renegotiated view of the pedestrian. Silently attending a familiar classical work under the conductor's calm, score-based authority was and is, in this sense, to take the aerial view, the call to urban order. And if, as the most dedicated audience members were wont to do, you brought to your experience your own authoritative score, one that could, perhaps bolstered by previous analysis, furnish you with a map of the entire work and could prevent you from being distracted by the performers and their all too human gestures, then so much the better. A potentially unpredictable pedestrian event, such as musical performance, could by these means become almost entirely aerial, almost entirely legible. And so, by means of this circuitous route, we can return to the new formalists, the old musicologists, and their shared insistence on close reading. Now, I quoted earlier Gary Tomlinson's warnings about close reading in the musicological sphere, and I hope they've now taken on a new significance, reminding us, and the us is musicologists as well as others, that close reading of music invariably means taking a determinedly score-based approach to the musical object, and thus has a history which can be charted and indeed may carry ideological charges. In that sense, it's obviously a different activity from close reading in words-based disciplines, but the comparisons may nevertheless be of some interest. Now, there's a passage in the middle of Levinson's article, review article, that seems to state explicitly the possibility of a cross-fertilization of this kind. She suggests that the literature she is reviewing, quote, would have profited from some discussion of the received meaning of formalism in 20th century theory and history of art and music. There is unfortunately no clue in the article as to what she might have meant by this, but there is a swerve at the end that might be dragooned into service. At a very late point in her argument, with the gloves coming off and many bodies already strewn around the stage, there emerges in Levinson's review article an unlikely heroine. This is English professor Elizabeth Harris Sagassa, and specifically a paper of hers about teaching Renaissance poetry. According to Levinson, Sagassa offers a beacon of light within the new formalist terrain because she offers her readers, quote, a rigorously interactive notion of form. She designs exercises, recitation, memorization, etc., to counteract the reification effects of contemporary print and academic culture, unquote. Now, another way of putting that might be that Sagassa has attempted to bring poetry nearer to the condition of music, in the process perhaps restoring to it something of what Hans Ulrich Gumbrecht has recently called presence effect. If Levinson is right in seeing this departure as of potentially great significance, then the study of words-based repertories may indeed, and finally, benefit from knowing something about how music has been studied, and so perhaps benefit from knowing something of musicology. As I said at the start, our recent musicological condition has been one of determined belatedness. Given the struggles we have with our principal object of attention, sounds that come to us through the air, this is hardly surprising. I'm reminded of a key figure in the twists and turns of the 1980s, the great German musicologist Karl Dallhaus, who was born in 1928 and died in 1989, and whose writings were famous for their elegant, complex, wearily melancholy conclusions about the impossibility of interpretative progress. In his short monograph, Foundations of Music History, is more or less the only book we have that explores this meta-historical aspect of musicology, and I like to imagine that its title is not without irony. In Foundations of Music History, the aporias step out of virtually every page. Dallhaus's conclusion is that, quote, musicology is one of those disciplines in which fundamental problems are not solved, but instead gradually become obsolete, only to be replaced by others equally incapable of being solved, unquote. There's a nice logo for the entire conference, isn't it? This may indeed be so, but musicology's recent upheavals may nevertheless raise questions about how far any humanistic discipline can escape what Levinson calls, quote, the reification effects of contemporary print and academic culture, unquote. Recently, we musicologists feel we have left some of our formalism behind, loosened our bonds, and emerged blinking into the bright light of a newly plural world. We are now free, or freer, to think harder about things other than reading scores, about listening, about performance, about what Tomlinson has called song, probably a better global word for what we call music, about innumerable repertories and musical activities that cannot be notated, about innumerable aspects of even the Western classical tradition that resist notation and that thus resist close reading. Will this take us still further away from other humanistic disciplines? Or will, say, literary scholars follow us and start listening to poetry rather than reading it as a prelude to their interpretative moves, so possibly escaping or diminishing those reifying effects that Levinson talks about? Now, I don't know the answers to these questions, but I do know that the sounding objects that our musicologist project will remain, listening to them gives most of us intense pleasure. But perhaps in the immediate disciplinary future, listening may also engender new anxiety. If we just listen to music, will we lose our ability to write? Thank you.